Bluegrass Jam Along is proud to be sponsored by Collings Guitars and Mandolins, each and every one built from the sound up in Austin, Texas. This episode is also brought to you by Peghead Nation, the home of roots music instruction. If you want to improve your playing, join me and thousands of other pickers getting better every day at pegheadnation.com. Hi, this is Matt, and you're listening to Bluegrass Jam Along, the podcast for anyone and everyone who loves bluegrass. My guest on Bluegrass Jam Along this week is Kyle Tuttle, who lots of you will know from being a member of Molly Tuttle's band, but he also has a fantastic new solo record out, and that is why he's here to talk today. Kyle, welcome to the podcast.
Howdy, Matt. Thanks for having me.
So congratulations on the album. I think by the time people hear this, it will be out, but your sort of second full-length album, Labour of Lust, is what we're here to talk about today. And it's quite a big sort of change from your last album, Bobcat. Particularly, I mean, they're both pretty eclectic records, but this one particularly has got songs on it.
Yeah, correct. It's got songs versus the old one only had tunes, if you want to put it that way, you know. This one's also got a wider range of instruments. So, you know, sounds, it's got some more electric stuff, some electric banjos. But I would say more importantly, it's got songs.
And it feels like that's the heart of the record. There's the tunes and the songs. Like, it's a really cool mix of stuff, but there's definitely kind of a real heart of this record in those songs. And it sounds like, from the stuff that I've read, that it was pretty meaningful record for you in terms of how that all came together and sort of what it represents in terms of what you're trying to communicate, I guess.
Sure. Yeah, it is. I don't know. You know, I don't know exactly what I'm trying to communicate per se, but it just came, songs. I when I made that other record, I intended it to be instrumental, you know, and when I took it on the road and started playing a lot of shows, I realized I immediately, upon touring that first album, Bobcat, realized that that's not how my show would go, not what I would want my show to go like, you know. And I've always liked writing stuff, you know. I mean, I was in punk rock bands and singing my own songs when I was a teenager and stuff like that. So that element of me was there too, I guess. But you know, now it's on record.
Yeah, and it's an interesting point, kind of not quite sure what you wanted to communicate. I think that's often the case when that's part of the joy of making art, is because you've got something to get out and you're not sure what it is till you get it out necessarily. But it felt like, as a listener, there's a real theme, like a sort of almost like a bookended theme on this record. It starts starts with a song about working through difficult stuff and sort of processing and sort of just talking yourself around into getting on with life almost. And there's a, you know, there's a couple of songs that have themes of that in, but there's a lovely, and we'll maybe come to this later, but there's a lovely Harry Nilsson track at the end that sort of brings it back around a little bit to some of those themes too. And it's, you know, I think the phrase that was in the stuff that I read earlier refers to the album as an honest look at the realities of grief and death while still finding swatches of musical joy and whimsy. And that's, it's got all of that in it, you know, and it's, I'd be interesting to sort of start with like what the grief you were processing was, because you talk about it pretty openly. It's on your website and in the press materials that come out with the CD. And I think it'd be really interesting for people to hear a bit about that.
Sure. Yeah. You know, it's, I started recording that record in 2018. So some of the stuff, you know, is kind of old and sort of predates all that other business. But then in 2019, I was playing in a band. I was playing, working with a friend and an idol, sort of, you would say, I guess, Jeff Austin, And he had been in the Yonder Mountain String Band, which I was a big fan of. And then I became a banjo player in his band, which was super cool, you know, for me. And I did that for 3 years. And then in 2019, Jeff passed away, unfortunately. And so that was big, you know, that was my job and a friend, you know. I lost, it was really in two spots of my life, or at least two, maybe more than that, really. Mm-hmm. And then also at the same time, I ended up going through a divorce, which is an unfortunate thing for anyone to have to do, you know, and that's something that you grieve also, you know. And as far as, I mean, honestly, as far as divorces go, it could have been worse, you know, or whatever. And that's for sure. And there's still a lot of love in that situation, but that's a tough thing. It's a tough thing for anybody to do, you know? So I know, and it sounds like a 90s country song, like the topics list of a 90s country song, right? You know, I lost my friend and I lost my job and I lost my girl. But I don't mean to sound all woe is me or nothing like that about it, you know. But some of the songs on the record are talking about that and sort of me processing those thoughts and experiences, you might say.
Yeah, because there's something else. There's sort of in the lyrics of other places as well, is just like, Saddle Up has a line about my past cannot be where my best is, so I saddle up and ride my buggy into town. It's that idea of like, I get up and I pick myself up and I carry on. And it, sort of, as I said before, it's, and I wonder, has that line also, you know, also who'll cry when I'm gone, and this idea of what you, and it reminded me a little bit of Death of a Salesman, and this idea that this guy knows he's going and he's planting things desperate in his garden because he wants to leave something behind, and how will he be remembered? But then the whole record sort of comes around to the end with this beautiful Nilsson cover of Turn Your Radio On, which, like, I don't know where I'm going now that I'm gone. I hope the wind that's blowing helps me carry on, sort of echoes that theme and draws it through the whole record. And the idea of turn on your radio, listen to my song, you know, and it's also that idea of when I'm not here, what will be? And so there's such a theme of that that runs through the songs for me.
Yeah, man, you really nailed it there. You've obviously listened, done your homework, because those are, it's like kind of all the spots that I would mention probably, you know. But yeah, that theme is there, you know, and almost all of this album is original material, you know, that I wrote. And that Nilsson one, man, turn on your radio. I always confuse it with the John Hartford song, Turn Your Radio On. Turn On Your Radio. That totally sums it up, you know, in a really beautiful way. Those words you know, just in my particular situation, and when I think about my friend Jeff, you know, who played in the band, I mean, turn on your record player, listen to my song, you know, it's an easy connection to make there. But there, I think that statement can go deeper too, in any way of just sort of remembering something that you have lost behind, have left behind, even if it's not as like actually direct as dropping a needle on a physical slab of vinyl with grooves in it, you know. But when in making the record, I guess, because like I said, I started in 2018 with some of the members of Jeff's band when we were on a little break from his band, and I was out touring. I would take those same dudes and go be the Kyle Tuttle band, you know, when we had a little time off from Jeff's band. And Jeff would go home with his family, you know, and we'd go run around and do my shows. And so we did some recordings on that. Max Johnson is on this record playing bass, and he was in that band at that time with me. anyway, I digress. That's I go through all that stuff, you know, and then you start making the record, and I keep progressing and doing these different sessions over time. And once I sort of noticed that that was a theme, let's say that maybe like loss, and that I was like maybe noticing that I was actually like working that stuff out in somewhat through song with myself and sort of coaching myself through what I wanted it to, what I wanted me to be, or how I wanted me to come to survive this whole thing, you know. Once I noticed, what I'm trying to say is, once I noticed that that theme was had a pretty solid undercurrent of the record, the Nilsson tune just seemed like the perfect thing to close on. Because, like I said, I don't know what I'm trying to say. I don't know what I'm trying to convey. What message I'm trying to convey with this album, and I don't want it to be super heavy and dark. I'm a happy fun time stoner banjo jamgrass guy. but I got feelings too. what I'm trying to say is that song, that Nilsson song, just as much as you could tie up something sort of in a nice eloquent bow on a package, and it's his words, not mine, but they resonate pretty heavily with me. So.
Yeah, and it sort of surprised me at the end just how, like, it felt like it was a song that was written to finish that thread of thought almost, you know. It's remarkable.
Yeah, I feel the same way, so that's why I you know, threw it on. There's another cover, there's an Earl Scruggs banjo cover on there too, of course, you know, but there's
yeah, and I just talking about that contrast, and you know, because there's a lovely little quote that came along with the stuff I was sent in advance that says, "A life in professional music or performance of any kind really is often painted in glamour, but the man behind the curtain can exist in a difficult duality. An attempt at putting a saddle on success can eat a person up and wreck the things they hold dear." And you know, whether it's through whatever we do, we tend to portray ourselves as the better versions of ourselves and the happy versions of ourselves. And it's, you know, it's easy to hide all the rest. And this is the ultimate sort of exercise in not hiding it, really, isn't it? It's putting it out in an album for people to hear it. But that balance, you know, as you say, you've got Ground Speed on there, which is like, it's fun. It's, you know, this is, it made me smile. Like, it's not funny, but it's fun, you know, and some of the bits on Scorch the Porch, or like just the moment where the clarinet comes in on I Wonder, that I wasn't expecting. Like, I hadn't read the credits at that point. I just put it on and listened. And there's lots of light moments in there too. And I think that contrast helps, you know. Sometimes albums that are dark and deep throughout work really well, but sometimes the contrast between the two things makes them stand out even more. We'll be right back with you just after this. We'll be right back with you just after this. Collings Guitars has been a long-time supporter of the bluegrass community, from collaborating with artists to sponsoring festivals big and small, and now by sponsoring Bluegrass Jam Along. Handmade in Austin, Texas, every Collings guitar and mandolin that leaves the shop is built from the sound up, and the team loves seeing a Collings in the hands of players of all levels, from local musicians to world-renowned pickers. Visit collingsguitars.com for more. This episode is also brought to you by Peghead Nation, the home of Roots Music Instruction. With 65 streaming video courses for guitar, mandolin, banjo, fiddle, dobro, bass and ukulele from some of the leading names in acoustic music, Peghead Nation has something for every picker. You'll learn the tunes and techniques you need to join in at jams and play the music you love, plus advanced techniques like improvisation, theory and ear training. Your first course is just $20 per month, and you can add more for $10 a month. Sign up for any course and get your first month free with the promo code JAMALONG, all one word. Join thousands of other players, including me, who are advancing on their instruments and having more fun playing the roots music they love at pegheadnation.com.
Yeah, and it's a big part of, you know, approach to life in a lot of ways. I'm a fun loving dude. I like to if something's getting serious, if something's getting pretty serious, I'm probably going to crack a joke or try and make somebody laugh or try and make myself laugh, more importantly, you know? So I'm not going to be able to create a piece of work that doesn't have some element of that stuff. You know, like you talk about that ground speed thing, man, Max Johnson, like flat picks a bass solo, like an electric bass solo. He's Max Johnson is flat picking an electric bass, electric fuzz bass, and like playing Earl Scruggs licks in his solo on it. And, you know, and it's like, I can't listen. I still can't listen to it without laughing, without like cracking up, listening to that part of that track specifically, you know, because, and that's I love my buddy Max, and that's real important to me to be able to capture that type of thing as a part of a recording too, you know, as a part of a project. I mean, as one element of a project.
And that was one of those moments. I was standing on a train platform waiting for a train to come home from work. And I was listening to Ground Speed. And at the point that I realized I'm listening to like a picked fuzz bass playing a G run. It's like,
yeah.
Okay. I mean, also just the sound of that electric banjo through a tube amp. And it almost has the sound of, I don't know if you've ever heard like people like Buddy Emmons sort of play fiddle tunes on a pedal steel. And it's got that fluidity and the sort of the, you know, there's a lot of picking that goes across the beats, and it's got that, just the sound of it, because it's got a bit less attack than an acoustic banjo. It's got just like, it's a whole other thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a whole different, that instrument is a whole different animal, and you sort of have to approach it differently than you do a real banjo, and I don't get to do it much these days, but there was a little point in time where my band almost always had drums and electric bass on the road. And I was playing that thing that was actually recorded obviously during that time, 2018. So I did have a good little run with the electric banjo, but it doesn't come out too much these days.
But it's interesting, because even the sort of like, I'm going to do air quotes here, people can't see them because it's a podcast, but like traditional banjo, there's a lot of treated acoustic banjo as well. There's, you know,
correct.
It's not just electric banjo or acoustic banjo. There's acoustic banjo with all sorts of things going on. There's some pretty electronica sounds. There's, you know, there's all sorts. And is that a pedal board as you're playing, or is that stuff that's put on afterwards, or is it a mixture of the two?
It's on this recording, it's mostly pedal boards being used a lot in real time. You know, there's a couple little things where I would reamp it, and, you know, take a clean banjo sound that's been recorded and then run that back through the pedal board and manipulate it at that point. But I would say that this is like 90% real time stuff. There's a Leslie, it's at one point, the track I Wonder is, and I think Two Big Hearts also is acoustic banjo run through a Leslie that's been stereo mic'd, you know, a real rotating speaker cabinet is what I'm talking about. If anybody doesn't know what a Leslie means, it's a rotating speaker in a box, and you put a microphone on each side of it, and then you separate those mics, so one of them's in one of your ears and one of them's in the other one of your ears, and what it sounds like, this banjo is like whirling back and forth between your ears. So that those tracks were done with my friend Megan McCormick here in Nashville, and she's just an awesome, really, really creative engineer, you know, and we lived together at the time, so our house was an excellent studio, and she mic'd up that banjo, and then we ran it through the pedal board, and all the stuff on Two Big Hearts with these, there's a couple of big old feedback swells, and then they get brought down. That was all done in real time with that's just me and Jeff Saunders on bass and James Kittleman on drums and Megan behind the board. So
cool. Yeah. And it's interesting with some effects that the nature of what they do to the sound, like you have to play with them in real time, because that's, you know, that's the deal. And some things work great afterwards, but there's a real joy in putting something on and then changing the way you think because it's doing something different.
There is, yeah, and also different, you know, different effects require you to play the instrument differently. You know, if you want that delay to really work, for example, you're going to have to play your notes a certain type of way to really get that sound. And then you can't, if you just play normal stuff and then you try and go back and adjust it, you're going to, not saying you can't make something cool, but that's part of the fun for me, because I was an electric guitar player, too, when I was a kid, you know, and so pedal boards and affected sounds, are nothing new, to me. So I have a lot of fun figuring out how to take the weird things about a banjo that make it unique and then still combine them in a way that is actually successful with some things like envelope filters and delay pedals and octave pedals and things like that, you know.
Are there certain kind of pedals that tend to work on banjo, and are there some that maybe don't? I remember talking to Jared Walker about what works on mandolin and what doesn't, and he said it's really impossible to get any kind of fuzz or distortion that sounds nice on a mandolin.
Yeah, same on the banjo. I think you sort of need low end, maybe, you know, because on a guitar, with the mandolin and the banjo, you just, our register doesn't go down there, you know. I can sometimes turn on an octave pedal and take my banjo notes an octave down and then apply a fuzz to that, and it's a little bit cooler. But at that point, it's not a banjo anymore. Anyway, it's getting down there into guitar territory, you know. Mm-hmm. But I find that, like, you know, phasers, there's, you know, Pete Wernick with Hot Rise sort of set it okay to use a phaser, you know, on the banjo. And on a lot of that old Hot Rise stuff, man, it's heavy. The engineer's got a heavy hand on that phaser. I mean, there's no mistaking that it's wishy-washy banjo sound. And so, you know, I like to, there's a phaser that I like. It's not quite as intense as the Hot Rise sound, but I find that works really well. I find that a long delay and a short delay can both work really well just for different applications. You got to have a reverb pedal on there because it just kind of makes your electric note sound more like an acoustic note, even for a half second, which is worth every penny of it, you know? So there's a lot of fun stuff that can be done.
I guess both banjo and mandolin are instruments that don't have a ton of sustain as well, which will affect what kind of things work on them. Because, you know,
big time.
I think what I enjoyed about this record first time around is that there's constantly something new. Like, there's a song, there's a tune you know, but not like you've heard it before. There's new sounds coming from instruments you know. There's instruments you don't expect. There's like a real sort of, like you talk about your sort of jam band roots and stuff in there, there's some real elements that take a nod to that, and it's just a sort of expect the unexpected kind of record, and I like that a lot about it. And it's particularly refreshing with like a track like Ground Speed that we've heard, like we know it, we love it. If you're going to do it, might as well do something different with it, you know. There's such a temptation for, I think maybe this is just where my head's at, because I've been talking to a lot of people about Earl Scruggs recently, because it's just been his 100th birthday. And there's such a strong thread in string band music of tradition and doing things the correct way. And like that can be really exciting and really fun. But just everybody I've talked to talks about how progressive a musician Earl Scruggs was in the first place. And like, you know, in your notes, it sort of says there's something in there about, no banjo album would be complete without a tip of the hat to Mr. Earl Eugene Scruggs. He had a progressive side, and let's think he'd dig this version. And like, you know, it's,
yeah,
it'd be cool to chat about Earl for a minute, you know, because it's just that phrase, no banjo album would be complete without a tip of the hat to Earl Scruggs. He's such a presence in everything.
Yeah, he's, I mean, you know, as we all know, like, he wrote the book literally and figuratively. You know, if you're going to play the 5-string banjo with 3 finger picks on, the more whatever you choose to do is informed by Earl's sound, the easier it's going to be for people to digest for some reason, and the better it's going to sound, the more the world is going to like it, you know, because we love Earl. Everyone loves Earl and that sound and that version of timing, you know? And but also the like lean, but the way that it's recorded on my record obviously is not a traditional way that you're going to hear it played with the electric banjo and the fuzz bass and stuff like that. But I find a little bit of the freedom maybe in not trying to exactly follow the rules to the tradition, the way that people, the way that tradition is such a big part of this thing. And I can't sound quite like Earl. Maybe the real deal is if I sounded a little more like Earl, I'd be happy to play it like him, you know, with that lineup or something. But yeah, everybody wants to sound like Earl, man. I mean, he's just the best. And what he was doing too was out of the box. Nobody had played that before. Nobody had played some of those, you know, he was hearing some of those horn lines and jazz ideas and getting some of that stuff onto the banjo, which nobody had done that before. But then also you got him coming along with Bill, and like the band essentially had been the same with different styles of banjo. You know, you had String Bean and Grandpa Jones or whatever, and these dudes. And then, here comes Earl plugged into that. And it's like, the whole thing is just like, there's your package. You know, you've been, he was innovative on multiple levels, you know. And then of course in much later years, when he goes and has the Earl Scruggs review with his sons, you know, there's another round of innovation coming from Earl, where he's out there with the electric bass and the banjo and I mean the electric bass and drums and the electric guitars and stuff, you know. I mean there's many sides to Earl for sure.
And it sounds, I talked to John McEwen last year about Doc Watson, and he was talking about the Will the Circle Be Unbroken sessions and what a major part of that Earl was and how he just got what they were trying to do. There was no sense of, you know, he went, yeah, that's a great idea. How can I help you get other people involved with that? Who do you want me to call, essentially?
Right. Yeah, he recognized the value in doing something like that, or if not even recognize the value, just didn't see any good reason not to do it, you know, which is maybe even more important, you know, because a lot of those old timers on that record, you know, might have needed some convincing to go do a session with a bunch of long haired hippies. But if Earl calls and says do it, then you're probably going to do it, you know?
Yeah, and it's interesting, isn't it? There's two responses to some questions, and one of them is why, and the other one's why not, and they're, you know, can take you in totally different directions.
Totally, and they take you in very different directions. Yeah, I know. Yeah, why not is such a better option, you know. But
yeah, and so you've studied banjo pretty intensively at college and also with like various teachers and players. And is Earl like a thread through it? Like, is it possible to learn the banjo without people teaching you some Scruggs style? Is that still the starting point for everything?
I don't think it would really be possible. I mean, it certainly wouldn't be possible to comprehensively learn the banjo without learning Scruggs style, because that's a major part. It's not the only way to play it. There are other ways, but even the other ways are like got to be subtly informed by Earl in some way or another. You know what I mean? Because you can play clawhammer, which for anybody that isn't familiar with it, it's hard a thing to describe. We're just talking about it, no seeing it, but it's more of a strum. It's more of like a down strum thing with your fingers and like a pluck with your thumb. And it's just you would call it maybe a two stroke motion. There's two activities that can happen, you know, and then Earl comes along and he's got the three fingers. So there's three activities that can happen. And there's just, yeah. There's two finger, you can play two finger style. Snuffy Jenkins played stuff like that. But and String Bean, but you can't, there's no way you could comprehensively study the banjo without studying what Earl Scruggs had done, because guys like Bela Fleck and Tony Trischka have Earl all in their stuff, you know, and these are guys who have broken barriers and created whole new areas of playing the banjo. But Earl's techniques are basically what made that possible, I guess you could even say.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it? Just how sort of constant that influence is. One of the things that's emerged from doing these conversations about Earl is just, it seems to be almost a unique thing that your job as a banjo player is basically to recreate what somebody did 70 years ago. And that's not quite the same on any other instrument I can think of.
No, and he's got to be, I've had this thought before, he's got to be one of the most imitated people, musicians on the planet, you know, because they're, like you said, no other instrument is so defined by one guy. I mean, yeah, there's a million people that try and play like Jimi Hendrix. There's a million people that try and play like Jimmy Page, you know, or Stevie Ray Vaughan or whatever. And there's all these cats, and there's a lot of guitar players, but man, there's a lot of cats that they try and do. But Earl is just the one that we all, you know, and even you can even be like, oh, well, he's trying to play like J.D. Crow or something. It's like, yeah, but he's trying to play like Earl. So there's, you know, even if you're trying to play like Bela, you know, I mean, there's so much, like I said, so much of what Bela does is informed by and using the techniques created by Earl that you are inevitably also still trying to play like Earl to some degree. So he's got to be one of the most imitated one of the most imitated human beings like to ever live, you know, which I think is super cool.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary thing, isn't it?
Like you said, you know, yeah, it's like, oh, wow, well, we're trying to recreate almost everyone. Our job in a big way is just to recreate this thing this guy did, you know, 70 or a little. Yeah. So 70 years ago or whatever, you know, a little bit more ago. But again, like, that's a long time in our lives and stuff. But man, in the span of music, the banjo is like brand new. You know, the piano, the way people shred on the piano has essentially been around for a long time. The way people shred on the violin, the techniques they use, the timing, you know, I'm not saying no one's created anything new on those instruments. Don't get me wrong. But the fundamentals were put in place much longer ago than the fundamentals that we're using to play the banjo. It's like brand new. That's like so exciting. And, you know, to me anyway.
Yeah. Anyway, just the thought that, you know, Earl, just through the invention of a set of tuners, had an effect on the physical instrument as well. You know, the instrument itself was still being perfected with
sure
changes in skins and changes in, you know, all of that. Yeah. It's a remarkable thing. I could talk to you about Earl all evening, but I'd like to talk about your record a bit more, if that's all right.
Okay, sure.
One of the things I was going to ask you about it is, like, you mentioned you've been in bands before this, and singing's always, so the singing wasn't necessarily a new thing for you, it's just a new thing within this context. And I was just curious how singing and playing three-finger banjo works, like if that's some sort of juggling, plate spinning whilst riding a unicycle kind of trick.
It's definitely a rub your head and pat your belly type of thing, you know, and say the alphabet backwards all at the same time. There's a couple of things, you know, I mean, if you think about like sort of referencing Earl still, right? I mean, it's the timing, what's goofy about the banjo is the forward roll or the 3/2 timing, however you want to put the syncopation thing. That's what makes the banjo so cool. It's also what makes it rhythmically stand out, so uniquely different from other things. It's also what makes it rhythmically more complex. And so to sing over that is a very difficult thing to do. But if you think about, like, you know, finger style guitar players, I mean, those cats have got a thumb pick and finger picks, right? And they may be using index middle, they may be using index middle ring, but even if they've got another even if they're using another digit to pick, at some points they're just using three for some kind of role at some, somewhere in there. So, and they're doing more four note pattern stuff. Those roles, the roles that, that those guys play often is more four note pattern stuff. So there's a way to get a role. There's a way to get a pattern happening that's more four note based than three note based with your right hand as a banjo player. And that is a big first step in trying to sing and play the banjo at the same time, you know, getting something that's not just thumb and index middle. Do you play the banjo?
I had a go at playing the banjo once. I play guitar.
Okay.
Yeah.
I see the guitar back there. So, but you don't play the banjo. Okay. So, this is your free banjo lesson, Matt, that you never intended to get in the first place. But a common thing that people do while they're playing the banjo and singing, like if you're going to sing backup or something like that, is a more of just like a boom chick thing. It's like a thumb note pick and a thumb low note with your thumb pick, and then the higher strings plucking with your index and middle fingers at the same time. Boom chick, boom chick, boom chick, boom chick. And there's not a lot of sonic value in that. There's rhythmic value, but there's not much. It's not, and if you add the chord value, it's that's not exactly what you want to hear behind this, the banjo player when he's singing. That's what I'm saying. I try to avoid that. It works all right when you got a full bluegrass band context. That's the common go-to, but that's often not my context. I got usually just a banjo and a fiddle and a bass in my band. Another guy that's a big influence on me in that specific department is Danny Barnes. I don't know if you're familiar with Danny Barnes, but he does some really cool stuff where he keeps the finger picks on, but he just slides his hand up the neck and is able to play some really strummy rhythmic type stuff. And then just slide his hand back and be playing bluegrass style, scrug style, if you will, banjo again. So I've studied Danny a lot in that department, trying to figure that out.
So it's interesting that lineup of, because the instrumentation on this album, like and the sort of treatment of the banjo, but also like the bass and the drums and the clarinet and like all this stuff, you know, it's interesting to hear that your sort of live lineup is generally you and a bass and a fiddle. Are you going to get to tour this record much?
I am going to do a run on this, and that's actually going to be a full bluegrass band situation, you know, guitar and mandolin and fiddle and bass and myself. And some special guests here and there are going to be joining us, I'm sure. But a lot of times when I take my band out these days, it's me on banjo and a fiddle player and a bass player, which is a really fun way to make music. You don't get the full bluegrass band sound, but you also sort of aren't held back by certain limitations that you are in, that are in place when you've sort of got that that full of a band sound. Plus the less moving parts you got, the weirder places you can go, sort of, you know. I love to extend jams and extend solos and take one song and stick it in the middle of another song, you know, after the third chorus, have a breakdown that goes into some weird place and then lands you in a new song. And then you do that whole song. And then after that one, you find some creative way to get yourself back into the first one. And that kind of stuff is typically done very much on the fly, you know? I find that with the fiddle and the banjo and the bass and all of us having being plugged in. And so like being able to sort of lean on some effects and use some bigger, more creative sounds too. It's fun acoustic too, but it's really fun when it's amplified and modified.
Yeah. And I guess maybe there's an element if people turn up and there's three of you rather than that sort of five, there's the expectation from the audience is slightly different as well. Because there's a certain sound you expect when you see five people
big time
playing those instruments, you know.
I should have, yeah, You said it better than me. I think that's maybe even more important, you know, is that there's not the expectation of like, oh, they're going to be like this, you know, not that we would or wouldn't be like that and that it doesn't matter. But when you look at the fiddle and the banjo and the bass, you're just like, huh, what's that? What are they going to be? You know, so we can be, I like to say that we can fake being a bluegrass band. We've got just enough of the stuff that when I roll and we boom, 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 and the fiddle, you know, we can fake being a bluegrass band to get through some bluegrass songs. And then we can also do some really off the wall, you know, stuff.
Yeah, it's cool as a listener. I really enjoy stuff that's kind of duos and trios and slightly smaller, because you get a chance to hear like the music being passed around between people a little bit more clearly than you do. It's like a different kind of conversation between the musicians, and you can maybe hear a bit more of the interplay, which some stuff gets lost with a bigger band, and you know,
totally.
Some of the information just gets a little bit buried, and I love that. I love hearing sort of how the music takes a journey between people and back again. And
right. Yeah. Yeah. Same. I mean, being a band leader, you know, you want to be in control of as much as you can while still making sure that everything gets out there and that everyone in the show has the opportunity to do their best and is in a situation where they're gonna be able to do their best, where they can hear things, where they feel comfortable, where they can just succeed, be set up for success, you know. And weirdly enough, sometimes a trio really feels like it, you achieve that a little easier, you know, because there's less lines of communication between the crew, the band, you know. And I almost always feel like I have the strength that I need, the musical power that I need with that. You know, sometimes you're like, damn, if we had a rhythm guitar up here, this would really be popping, you know, but we don't. But often I don't feel that way.
Yeah. And sometimes it's maybe sometimes better to feel that way than to have it there and wish you had more space.
Sure. Yeah, you know, exactly. Like, well, I mean, and that's, you know, how do you think I got here, man? that's how we got here, man. You know, because I did, when I first toured that album, when I had lived in Nashville, I had been to school, I had been in bands, I had done lots of things, but I had not been a band leader ever until after I put out that Bobcat record. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to take this on tour, you know? So there's a whole new set of responsibilities and a whole new set of tasks. And so in that way, like, even though I had been all up and down the road, I had never approached it like that before, you know? And so that was a whole new, I'm still newer at that, even though I've been up and down the road a million times and done a million shows, more than a lot of people have. When it comes to being a band leader, I still got plenty to learn, you know? And I like that about it, you know? But going out and doing those shows with that Bobcat record really put me in the situation for the first time where I had the ability to choose and create everything about the sound, you know, and that sort of struggle of like always having a hard time hearing the banjo over the years, you know, because banjos are difficult to amplify. It's not anyone's necessarily fault. But you know, and always and the rig not being ideal or whatever. My personal rig, I mean, that it basically just led me to be like, all right, how do I remove things and still get what I need done? You know what I mean? And where I landed there was the fiddle, bass, and banjo thing.
And that must have been an interesting journey to be on, sort of playing with Molly Tuttle over the past few years, because presumably the venues just keep getting bigger. And, you know, then that's a... It's an irony.
Stayed the same size.
Yeah, and the irony is that in a jam situation, the banjo is not the thing you're struggling to hear, right? But live, it is. It's a difficult sound to get across. And just, I mean, from all sorts of levels, just from that side of it, but also Molly must have had to learn a lot about leading a band in the past 5 years as well. It's been a really interesting journey to watch because you guys look like you're having such a huge amount of fun out there doing those shows. It looks like a gas, you know.
It is, to use your word, a gas for sure. It's really exciting, you know. It's only been 2 years. We're just going now into the third year, you know, with that project, and everything is just. Yeah, every time it's been really humbling to watch. Every time we come back to another city, it's a bigger space and there's more people there. You know, every time we come back to the same city, it's a bigger space and there's more people there. It's sonically you learn. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely growing pains with anyone when the rooms start to get a lot bigger. It's like, okay, well now this instrument is about to be a lot louder than it used to be. And we still need to be able to make it sound good. Ideally better. Ideally it's going to be a lot louder. It needs to sound better than it used to sound actually. Cause you're going to be able to hear more people are going to hear it. You're going to be able to hear more of it, you know, ideally. So there's never, you know, there's gear, musical gear, is a never ending search, just like finding the right banjo, you know, just like any people, you want to find the right guitar, you want to find the best instrument for your skill, for your art, you know, for you to use. But then, gear is just like that, man. I mean, and there people are always trying to make better, newer direct boxes, newer preamps, and so it's a never ending journey of trying new stuff and trying to figure out what's going to be the best, and then using it for a while, and then someone else saying, "Oh yeah, well, have you tried this one yet?" You know, and then you try that one, but I've always been a gearhead too. So I'm maybe for other people, I think for a lot of acoustic musicians, it's maybe not quite so extreme, but like I said, I was an electric guitar player when I was a kid and punk rock bands and screaming tube amps and bunch of boxes, bunch of pedal boards and stuff like that. So that's, I've always had a love of a love and understanding of toying with sounds and trying to get the best one you can get, you know?
Yeah, I think for a lot of acoustic players, there's a sort of sense that plugging anything in is a necessary evil, and you know, it's just attempting to get a clean, nice sounding amplified acoustic sound is a hard thing. But it also offers you opportunities to try something different.
Yeah, I mean, and I would almost say, well, I don't know if I said it that well earlier, but I was trying to say there's some freedom in sort of divorcing yourself from this mentality of like, oh, well, you know, Earl played it like this, so I've got to play it like this, or like the tone of the notes has got to be, you know, it's got to sound, the presentation of the banjo has got to sound like Earl did it. And I'm like, let's put a phaser on it, you know, like that'll be cool. Then it's kind of makes it different. It's the same kind of thing, I think, with having to plug your instrument in, because for a lot of people, I don't want to speak for anyone specifically, but for a lot of people, it feels a lot of acoustic musicians, it feels like a necessary evil, and they're going to plug it in because they have to, and they're going to try and get the best sound they can get that replicates the way that awesome, you know, $30,000 instrument sounds when it's sitting in a room with a $10,000 microphone on it, you know? And I get it. I know why we all want it to sound that way. I mean, that's because it sounds really dang good and that's what we like. But with the banjo, man, with the electric banjo, with my acoustic banjo plugged into a pedal board, I don't really go for, I'm shooting for something that sounds good and it's got an artificial low end. You know, it's a little fatter, a little warmer than the most banjos sound. And then I've got effects that lean into that low end sound. So that helps me to simulate a little bit more of a body and a little bit more of a, of a, of a something substantial than a lot of electric, than a lot of what you hear when you hear a plugged in acoustic banjo, you know? And I think it works really well for me. And I think it works really well for the banjo. And I think it complements the music in almost, in pretty much any situation that I'm going for. It seems to work. So far it's working for me, I guess I should say. But I know that I'm going for like a little bit more electric, a little bit more. I'm not trying to make the thing sound like it sounds like acoustic, because I know you can't do that. So I think personally, I enjoy a little bit of freedom and a little lack of stress on the way my instrument sounds because I feel that way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a really interesting, like that word for it. It's really interesting to call it freedom, because that, like, sort of taking it back to where we started all this and talking about the variety on this record, and it feels free. It's not like you could make an album of the songs. You could make an album of the more sort of jam band tracks towards the end of the records. You could make an album of the tunes, and this album's got them all. And it just sounds like that freedom is a really interesting word, because it sounds like somebody just exploring like what they hear and going, well, where does this go? Where does that go? Let's go over here for a bit. Where does that fit in? And it's just, it makes it an exciting listen.
Oh man. Well, thank you very much, Matt, for the kind words about that. I appreciate that. I think that's a lot of the goal, you know, if there is anything that I'm trying to impart by on a listener from listening to the album, it's just like, I want it to feel good and feel, fun, you know. And I think that's my goal all the time especially that's always my goal with my show. If you're going to see the Kyle Tuttle Band show, it's going to be fun, you know. There might be some slow and sad or songs or something, but that's like, you know, unless you catch me on a real sad day, I mean, maybe you'll catch a sad show or something, but mostly it's fun. That's one of the things that I guess that I love about music is that, you know, it gets you together with your friends, and the people that are in my band are always my friends. So I'm having to pull my friends through some pieces of music that they're maybe kind of familiar with, but not that familiar with, you know, and we're always sort of on the edge of our seats. And when you get the band on the edge of their seats, then the audience is really going to be on the edge of their seats, you know. And that's, to me, that's when that's the fun stuff. That's what I love about, it's not about, getting out there and re-delivering your music a bunch of times successfully. Not that there's anything wrong with that. That's awesome. That's what professional music is built on, getting out there and successfully re-delivering your message over and over and over again. I just like to have as much fun as I can possibly have with it, you know, and I hope this record still purveys that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it really does. And there's just that, there's that fun in, like, as an audience, even listen to a recording that is all already happened by the time you hear it. But it's the sense that I can't predict where it's going to go, because you don't entirely know until it's finished. Whereas, you know, there's still, you know, there's gaps to be filled and colored in there for you. So there's going to be for us as listeners. And it's always an exciting thing. I hope this record does really well for you, and I hope the tour is a bunch of fun. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. It's been a treat.
Yeah, thank you very much, Matt. I appreciate that. It's definitely been a pleasure to chat with you, man, for sure. So thanks for having me, and thanks for digging the record.
Bluegrass Jamalong is proud to be sponsored by Collings Guitars and Mandolins, making some of the finest guitars and mandolins in the world since the 1970s. Visit collingsguitars.com and find out why.